Today on The Grave Talks, the historic Scott County Jail, a conversation with Miranda Young. The historic Scott County Jail in Huntsville, Tennessee, isn't what you'd expect. This jail, which opened in 1904, looks more like a creepy medieval castle. It actually looks like a place that once housed prisoners and now houses their spirits. Today, this historic jail has been transformed into a museum and a hub for paranormal research, thanks to the efforts of Miranda Young and Christy Sumner, passionate paranormal investigators with a deep appreciation for history. The jail has reopened its doors for tours and investigations, and it seems the jail's former inmates and employees are still there with stories to tell. Today on The Grave Talks, a conversation about the paranormal activity at the historic Scott County Jail with Miranda Young. So, Miranda Young with me today. You were on the show just a couple months back, and I would highly recommend everyone go back and listen to the Ghost Biker Explorations episode. You have such an interesting life, Miranda. I don't know, do you get enough sleep? I'm a little concerned about that.
I don't. And, you know, now that I'm doing this with my life, with co-owning the jail, I get even less sleep.
Well, and as we record this, we're just out of the holiday season. And you did, which I thought was really interesting, because a lot of paranormal tours, ghost tours, that sort of thing, during the holidays, people don't think, that's what I want to do. But you did some ghost stories, holiday tours of the jail, and you did them right up to Christmas time.
We did, and that's something we actually really pride ourselves on, is thinking outside the box and trying to come up with unique tours that will accommodate people year-round. You know, some of these big cities like Savannah and, you know, Salem and all of those, they do ghost walks and stuff year-round. Well, being here in rural East Tennessee, we don't have all the stories that they have. But one of the big traditions, especially in Appalachia, is telling ghost stories at Christmas. So we thought that we would be creative with our walk that we do there at the historic Scott County Jail that goes through the town of Huntsville, Tennessee. And we thought we would capitalize on the fact that they put up some of these beautiful and amazing Christmas lights all throughout the town. And so we do a two-hour walk. It's about a 45-minute walk through the town, through the Christmas lights. We're sharing the history as well as the ghost stories that came out of the Huntsville, Tennessee and Scott County area. And then the tour ends with a hour and 10 minute flashlight tour of the jail. We've got decorations inside the jail as well, but we share the history. We share some of the captures that some of our paranormal teams have captured there, whether it be on video, photo, or through audio evidence. They get to see that in the spot where it was captured inside the jail. And we actually, this past year, just won an award for our Ghost of the Past at Christmas ghost walk that we do.
Well, congratulations on that.
That was through the Tennessee Association of Museums that we won that.
The historic Scott County Jail is very interesting as far as architecture. It actually does not look like a building you would find in rural Tennessee. It almost looks kind of medieval, something that you'd find in Europe. It almost has this castle look to it. It's built from sandstone. Can you kind of describe the architecture?
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's not something that you would typically see in the mountains of rural East Tennessee, but it is a sandstone castle. When it was originally built, it was only two stories. There was a fire back in 1922, and that caused them to fix the second story and add the third story. Now, when it was originally built, it was still built like a castle. It's made out of locally mined sandstone, and that was done right back in behind the jail. The blocks are 3x4x5 feet thick sandstone blocks. So it's a very formidable structure. They built it in the area in 1904. They built it where they did and the way that they did because there was an influx of people coming to the area for the coal and timber boom that we had. So they really wanted to show that they meant law and order. And so that's why they built it in that castle type structure that we're known for.
When I saw it, I was wondering if it was originally built as a jail, and it was then.
Yes.
That's interesting. You know, they say that limestone has some kind of properties that may be a conduit with paranormal activity. Do they say the same about sandstone?
They do. Sandstone is very rich in quartz as well as limestone. So it is a really, really good conductor of paranormal activity. We also have a river that runs right in behind. It's called New River. And so with the iron bars that's there, as well as all the different history that happened inside the jail, we believe that that really holds that activity in and acts as a really good conductor.
So now, it was originally, I read, built to house around 50 inmates. Well, I guess maybe, though, when it was only two stories, it housed fewer than that?
It did. When it was two stories, it housed up to 32 inmates to one jailer. And then whenever the third story was added in 1922, it had a capacity of 50 inmates to one jailer.
And frequently was overcrowded?
Yes. A lot of county jails really tend to have that problem. And so there have been several years where we've had almost as many as 100 inmates to one jailer. Basically, anywhere that they could throw down a cot and lock the door, they would do that when they had times of overcrowding.
Did they also have women in there? Was there a women's area if need be?
Yes. It did house both men and women. There were cells on the first, second, and third floors that women could use. The third floor is maximum security, so those that were held up there were the maximum security inmates. Those that were held on the second floor for a period of time, those were the trustee inmates, so those would have been the more trusted ones, the ones that helped to maintain the jail, did, you know, road crew cooking, that sort of thing. And then the one on the first floor, that was used during the later years, and that would have been just kind of a general population cell.
And as with most older buildings like that, you know, there's some serious history that happened, and that's why I'm fascinated by these old jails and prisons, because when you think about the people who came through and the history that they had, and here now they're stuck in this jail, and there's all of the emotions that would be going with it. So on top of that, there's always these very fascinating stories that all of these jails and prisons have, like escape convicts, or there's suicides and things like that. And this is no exception. It had some very interesting stories that happened. And there was one in particular I read about Jerome. I don't know how to say his last name. Jerome Boyett? Boyett?
Yes. Yes. Boyett.
So can you talk about his story?
Absolutely. So we've had so many interesting stories that have come out of there. And probably the most infamous one would probably have to be the lynching of Jerome and Boyett and Harvey Winchester. We have something in this area that we refer to as Mob Mountain Justice. We have had at least six inmates that we know of that have been taken out of the jail via Mob Mountain Justice. Mm. And basically what that is you would have your inmate inside the jail. Basically, justice didn't move swift enough for the folks of the community. So you would have groups of people, anywhere between 25 and 50 people, who would mask up go in and overtake the jailer, because at that point in time, the jailer and his family did live on site. So they would overtake the jailer and any guards that were there and go in, take the inmate out, and then either lynch or execute them on various parts of the property of the jail. And so Jerome Boyett and Harvey Winchester, those were our last two inmates to be lynched from there, and that was in 1933. They were young guys. Jerome was 23. Harvey Winchester, we've seen different reports. One says 17 and one says 19.
Oh, he was but they just were in young.
There very, very young. And they were in there for unrelated crimes. Jerome Boyett, he was from the area known as No Business, and he was a 23-year-old guy. He was also a moonshiner, but he had been out on a train with a family member, and they were playing cards on a boxcar coming back from Stearns, Kentucky. And so a call had been put in to law enforcement in the neighboring community of Pickett County saying that Jerome and his friend were disturbing the peace. So the train was ordered to stop and wait until the Sheriff Winningham and his son got to on site. And so once they got there, there was a dispute, and depending on who you ask, there is varying reports that says some say Jerome shot first, some say that the Winninghams shot first. But regardless, there was a shootout, and Jerome ends up killing Sheriff George Winningham and his son Floyd Winningham. So Jerome goes on the run, and he's on the run for a couple months. Some people say that the folks in the community of No Business were essentially putting food and stuff out to help him while he was on the run. And while he's out, a posse from Pickett County, which is a neighboring county to us, shows up at Jerome Boyett's dad's house. His dad's name was Ransom Boyett. And so they showed up asking for Ransom to give his son up. And so Ransom says he doesn't know where he's at, that he's not going to give him up. They arrest him, and then they end up letting him go and telling him that if he finds out where he's at, for them to let him know. Well, the posse ends up coming back and actually kills Jerome Boyett's dad. They end up hanging him in the barn. Jerome finds out about this. And really, the community didn't want Jerome to find out, because they knew if he found out, he would turn himself in. And if he turned himself in, he would probably have the fate that he ended up having. But he did find out about it. He came to the historic Scott County Jail, turned himself in. He was in jail for about 8 days, and a mob of 50 people bust into the jail, and they go up there. They take both him and Harvey Winchester out to about a mile and a half from the jail, and they brutally execute them. Essentially, you know, stripping them naked, tying ropes around their neck, forcing them to run, and shooting at them while they were running, and then eventually executing both of them. Now, Harvey, he was in there. He had the story goes that he had gotten drunk and was basically just kind of shooting his gun off into the air and just kind of acting a little bit wild. And so one of the local deputies and his son shows up, and Harvey ends up killing that deputy. So essentially, both Jerome and Harvey, even though they were in there for unrelated crimes, they were essentially both cop killers. And so Harvey had been in there 6 or 7 months. And so they ended up putting him and Jerome together. I'm not sure if it's because they were both young guys, but that regardless, you know, they didn't deserve what happened to them. And they were the last ones to be executed there from the jail. Now, that was a pretty common thing. Like I said, I know of at least six that's happened to. We do believe that there may be more, but those are the ones that we've actually got the newspaper articles for, as well as the death certificates. And that's what we really try to stick to with what we tell there on our tours.
Do you think with the mobs like that, either it would be impossible to be in law enforcement because you have no control over them. You almost have to just step back and let them go, or they're going to kill you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because they're on a mission. Or were they kind of in cahoots at times as well? Could it have been a little of both?
There's stories, depending on who you ask. There are stories that in some of these instances, they could have been involved. I do know that the jailer that was on duty that night there at the jail when Jerome and Harvey were taken out, the sheriff, he was actually on a moonshine run that night, so he was not on the property, but the jailer was on site, and he was actually beaten so bad there at the front door whenever the mob came through that he got the nickname Anvil because they said that he looked like he had been beaten like an anvil. And it's interesting because some of our paranormal teams have actually captured evidence that we've been able to go back and fill in questions or fill in parts of the history and the story with the evidence that these teams have captured. And that word anvil that I just mentioned was actually something that one of our paranormal teams had captured in the area where the attack had taken place. And we didn't know about that until we had reached out to a local author who just happened to be the grandson of the Anvil, or the jailer that was on duty that night. And when we questioned him about it, based on a book he had written, he was able to confirm that that's where Anvil had come from. And the team who had come in, they knew nothing about the story when they were doing the investigation.
Now, that is so fascinating to me.
Yeah, it actually, yeah, the author was not, he was rather skeptical when it came to the paranormal. And so he had put a book out based on that called The Quest for Rome. And the book had not come out at the time of the investigation, but he had actually given us an early release copy of the book. And we saw that the book was written as told by the story of a guy named Anvil Clemons. Well, Anvil Clemons is not the real name. That's actually a copyright character name. He had changed the name of the real guy. The real guy on duty that night, his name was Ethan. And, you know, the team, they just happened to get the word anvil three times on one of their obeluses that they were using. And so they asked me if there was any significance to the word anvil, not even knowing that it was a name. And so I had just happened to be reading the early release copy of that book and saw the name Anvil. So that's when I reached out to the author, and he was actually blown away because he said nobody knew about that nickname. And he said, and that's why I chose to name that character that, because I didn't want people to know the actual character's name, and I wanted to use the nickname because he had gotten it from that night when he was beaten. So it actually made a believer out of that author when we met with him and shared that story. And he's constantly going around telling folks about it when he's talking about his book, because it really blew him away.
What about Jerome? Do you think he's still in the jail? Any ideas maybe that he might be?
Yeah, we do get a lot of activity, especially on the third floor, from Jerome and from Harvey. We've also had mediums and psychics who have come in that have, they pick up on sort of a mischievous type energy, especially in that area. Teams have also captured, they've got the name Rome, which was the name that Jerome did go by. And they also have gotten other things like other words, statements, when they start talking about that, especially talking about somebody who's scared, you know, that they're coming to get him. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of activity relating to that. But then we also get kind of, anytime we get some mischievous activity or practical jokes being played on us, we're told that is Jerome and Harvey.
That surprises me because I just think of their lives as so tragic. I wouldn't think of them as being jokesters. You know, I think of the end of their lives and how horrible it must have been.
Absolutely. And that's what we thought too. But it's been interesting because that's been something that we've not really told people about. And when they come up there, we've had multiple people pick up on a prankster type activity. And they're like, if you've got things that end up missing, things that are moved around a lot, or just, you know, practical jokes being played, it's Jerome and Harvey. And that's something that really surprised me as well. But we have had multiple people pick up on that.
What about any of the jailers? Because I always think, and I've talked to so many different jails and prisons, and it's all the same. You know, just as there are prisoners there, there are jailers still there because that was their job. That's what they did. And they needed to stay there and protect everybody, and they had a job to do. And so many of these places still have those spirits around. Do you think that's the case there?
Absolutely. Especially up on the third floor, which is maximum security, we have an area that's known as the jailer's walk. And we get some of the best footsteps that go through there. We do believe that those are probably residual footsteps from a jailer because we've been able to really correlate that with specific times of day and night that this has happened on a regular basis. It tends to happen, especially at night, between 10 till and 10 after the top of the hour. We believe that that would have been around the times whenever the jailers would be coming up and doing their head count or just going to check on the inmates themselves. Those footsteps was really creepy and fascinating at the same time about those is they'll start going and they'll sometimes it'll just be one or two footsteps, but a lot of the time they'll go anywhere from 13 to 15 footsteps, which would be the full length of one of the cell blocks if you are right around a 6 foot tall person. And so we've caught those multiple times on our security cameras. We've also had that happen when we've been given tours, and it's really quite frightening when it happens, but we do believe that it's probably a residual haunting of a jailer that's up there on that third floor.
That makes sense because he would be doing his rounds and doing his job and checking on the inmates. That's what he does at those specific times.
Yeah, and you can almost feel the footsteps when it happens. They are like a heavy combat boot, and they kind of have a sticky sound, like almost whenever you've mopped a floor and the floor's drying. Everyone that's played them for us or that's described them, they describe them the same way. And we actually play those footsteps that we caught on our security cameras on our tour whenever we do the jail up in that spot. And there have actually been times that after we've played them, it's triggered them to, you'll hear somebody on the jailer's walk walking towards you. And we've had people on our tours get a little frightened when that happens because you really think that someone has come into the building. It's so loud and just you feel the presence.
Or the other thing they would think is that you're just messing with them. It's like, true. We'll get him.
True.
This will scare him.
We've had it happen on one tour, and you know, the ladies that was on that tour, they thought that my business partner had come in, and she was actually giving a tour at another location that we have. And so when we came out and showed that the door was locked, it really creeped them out then because they were like, that really was something out there and not somebody who had come in on us.
And there would be such a difference between playing the audio for them and then hearing it. In
yes.
The building, it would just hearing.
It's
it
a very
in the building.
Echoey building, yeah. Building as well. So you actually hear the echo whenever they're walking. It's like I said, you almost feel that someone is just going to come right around that corner, and you just don't know what you're going to see. But we have actually never seen any type of visual that goes along with the audio on the cameras, or even with somebody, you know, being there. We've never seen anything. We've just heard it.
And I was reading about another sheriff there who was actually killed right outside of the jail, Sheriff Ellis. I think it was Ellis. Eilis?
Yes.
Ellis. I don't have my glasses on. I think it's Ellis. But he was killed right outside of the jail. Tell me a little about him.
Yes. Sheriff Richard, or R.D. Ellis, he was killed right outside the front door. And he is one of our resident spirits that we get both intelligent and residual activity really on all three floors from him. He seems to be one that's very commonly with us. Back in August of 1925, Sheriff Richard Ellis was bringing in a prisoner, George Foster, and he had actually been out on a moonshine run. Brought this guy in, and as he was unlocking the gates there at the front door, somebody snuck up behind and shot him in the back of the head, ambush style, and then ran off into the night. Now, Sheriff Richard Ellis did run in 1920. He ran under the stance that he was going to make Scott County as dry as the Sahara. So he was really, really against moonshining. And moonshining was a very, very big and popular thing in our area, especially at that time. So you can understand that his stance was not very popular with the common person there. And so he had been warned that if he did that, that he probably would not make it through his term. And so essentially he put a target on his back, and they do believe that it probably was somebody relating to the moonshiners, but it's still one of Scott County's unsolved murders to this day. Nobody knows who did it. And so because at that time, sheriffs or jailers, they did live on site there at the jail. So Sheriff Richard Ellis did live in the bottom, the first floor of the jail. So his body was brought in, and they did have his wake and funeral there inside the jail. Couple notable things about Sheriff Richard Ellis. Not only, you know, was he very strongly against moonshining, but he was a Baptist preacher, and he was extremely tall. He was 6'8". And so one of the shadow figures that we do see there, especially around the drunk tanks, is a very tall, between 6'8" and 7-foot shadow figure. And it's interesting, the placement being there by the drunk tank.
Yeah.
Different teams have had very interesting conversations with an entity that does tend to stay there, that has answered questions, leading us to believe that it was Sheriff Ellis. Also, people have caught him up on the third floor. He seems like he was very proud of his job as a sheriff, and also of you know, the jail and everything. And so we do believe that he likes to hang out there and kind of help us keep the more ornery spirits in check, and that he, you know, is just there continuing his job.
I find that so interesting, because when you were first telling the story, I had thought some criminal who he had maybe locked up at one point came running up and shot him as a revenge thing. But the moonshiner thing makes a lot of sense. That would be money. He's messing with their money, their lifestyle. They like to drink.
Mm-hmm.
And he's messing with all that.
Absolutely. And moonshining and ridge running at that time was, you know, based on the time, I mean, it was a multi-million dollar thing at the time. You know, it was something that was a very big industry here in the South, and especially here in this area. And so people were very, very upset. And really, a lot of our early inmates there in the early 1900s, really up until about the 60s, were in there due to the illegal making of moonshine.
And you said that some teams have picked up, had conversations with him. Do you know kind of some of that information that they got from him off the top of your head?
Sure. Yeah, there was actually a team out of West Virginia that was just there. And they had been down on that first floor. People will get activity right there by the gates where he would have been unlocking the door. This particular team had gone outside, was asking some questions. Things got really quiet when they were out there. Now, when they were about to wrap up their investigation, so they were asking questions about how he had gotten killed and asking if he knew who had killed him, that sort of thing. Well, they weren't getting any responses, so they end up coming inside the jail, and they went over to the drunk tank area. Now, interestingly enough, the drunk tanks are actually our current restrooms. And so
I don't know why that made me laugh, but I kind of like that idea.
It's actually pretty awesome because whenever you come to the jail to take a tour, and if you go into the restroom there, you actually get to use an actual jail restroom. And so inside the restroom there, they actually had a tripwire, which is it looks like a set of Christmas lights, but those lights are EMF lights. So they're only set off through static or EMF fluctuations. So they had this 12-foot long tripwire sitting there in the drunk tank. They also had multiple voice boxes. They had a spirit box, and they also had ghost tube going. So once they were getting ready to wrap everything up, once they came into the drunk tank area and started asking questions, all of a sudden, they got the word shot. And of course, that really excited them because, of course, Sheriff Richard Ellis was shot. And they said, "Are we talking to you, Sheriff Ellis? Did you get shot? And are you here with us?" And right at that point, the tripwire, which hadn't lit up all night, ends up lighting up right there in the bathroom. So they were getting some very direct responses. I remember those two responses in particular, they do believe had related to Sheriff Richard Ellis.
Now, I'm going to guess that you have spent a lot of time in the jail, obviously. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't listened to the Ghost Biker Explorations episodes that I did with Miranda a couple months ago, give those a listen because you have a very interesting background yourself because you will go and do these investigations on your own, which hats off. I could never do that. So I assume you've spent quite a bit of time in there, and I'm going to guess even by yourself. Have you had quite a bit of activity and experiences yourself?
I have. And so, like you said, I am a solo investigator. I do co-own this with my business partner, Dr. Chrissy Sumner from Soul Sisters Paranormal. And it's just the two of us. And so between the two of us, we kind of split the daytime and the nighttime tours back and forth. I do a lot of the nighttime stuff just because I'm more of a night owl. But between the two of us, we'll be in the jail anywhere from, you know, up to 16 hours a day. So we're in there for a long time. And a lot of the time for me, after the investigation teams leave, then I go up, I clean up the cells, get everything ready for whoever is opening the next day for the museum tours. And so I've caught several things on security cam footage while I've been doing that. I saw a full body apparition through a reflection in a piece of glass there on the second floor. Also, probably one of my favorites was we had just had an investigation. They had left. It was about 3:30 in the morning. They'd been gone about 30 minutes. I had gone up, got everything ready. And so I was getting my stuff together to leave. And while we do the paranormal investigations, one of us is usually there inside the office, and so which is the gift shop. So I was going across the hall there to put some stuff in the booking room, and I heard this really loud, deep hum come from the second floor stairwell. And I first thought maybe it was a car. It went for about 3 seconds, and then it clears its throat and goes for another three. So as soon as it clears its throat,
not a car.
It was not a car. And so it kind of froze me for a minute because I was totally not expecting that. So you see me on the security camera footage come back into the gift shop to get my stuff to leave. And I'm a little bit surprised and shaken that I had heard that. And so I get my stuff and then leave. Well, I reached out to my business partner who was coming in the next day. And I said, hey, Chris, go back and look at the camera at this time to see if we captured that humming on the stairs. And so the next day she calls me and she's like, so we didn't catch the humming. But interestingly enough, at that time, when you come back into the gift shop, she said, you see, you come in and there's two voices. And now I heard something out in the hall, but it wasn't a voice that I heard. I just kind of heard some movement. But on our security cam footage, you actually hear one of the voices say, there she is. And the other says, not so loud next time. And so we believe that, you know, from that point on, we've been seeing trends and stuff to where our spirits, I mean, they're very intelligent. They're very aware of what's going on around. And so we believe that they were essentially having a conversation, one of them about me being there and then telling whoever was humming up on the stairs not to be so loud next time.
That's fascinating.
It very much. And the fact that this was very, very early on, not long after we had opened the doors. And so I find through a lot of my investigations that a lot of these new places that have not been overly investigated tend to have a lot of disembodied voices and a lot of EVPs that because they don't necessarily maybe know how to manipulate all the tools and such, but they tend to provide more EVPs. And so we were finding that, and especially since that was, I mean, I think we'd only been opened a few weeks whenever we captured that EVP. And so that's one we do show on a lot of our different tours that that we give there at the jail because it's so clear and was captured there on that security camera footage.
And that wraps up part one of our conversation with Miranda Young about the historic Scott County Jail. For more information on tours and paranormal investigations, visit their website at historicscottcojail.com. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, you can become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts today where you can try it for 3 days free. You could also sign up on patreon.com/thegravetalks. Find everything there, also all ad-free. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thank you for listening.